Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, Apple wants to crush all your hopes and dreams. Into a super thin tablet, that is. Yes, there was much angst online last week when Apple rolled out a new advertising campaign for their super thin iPad, in which a variety of creative tools, you know, from instruments to video game consoles to metronomes to those cool little wooden anatomy things that you put on your desk and then you put the lights on it and then you can learn how to draw shading properly. You know, it's one of those little cool drawing things that people have. I want to get one of those so I can work on my shading. Anyway, they were placed into a pneumatic press and then mercilessly crushed into nothingness by the relentless force of our mechanical age. The most powerful iPad ever is also the thinnest, a young person's voice says at the end, and people got mad. Oh, they got mad. They got so mad that Apple CEO Tim Cook issued an apology, saying that they missed the mark, et cetera, et cetera. They'll do better. Okay, so there are two avenues of critique here that at least make sense to me. I understand them. One is that Apple seems to be entirely ignorant of the growing resurgence in love for analog tools, right? It feels like now more than ever, creatives are really diving back into the world of the physical rather than the digital. LP sales are booming. Polaroids are back, baby. Ritualistically destroying such things feels, at best, gauche. The second avenue of critique here, and the one I think most people are kind of intuitively feeling, is the idea of the future remorselessly crushing the past, the rise of AI stepping on the skulls of all of us like so many Terminator exoskeletons wandering the war-ridden landscape, right? Just a soulless amalgam of everything that has come before. An idea slurry, if you will, right? Just thousands of years of human civilization run through a large language puree that's spits out baby food culture the masses can consume. I'm more sympathetic to this line of argument, as listeners of the show know. But I do think, look, I think in this case, it's a little overwrought. Like, the thing that's throwing me off about some of the criticism of this ad is that people are being super literal about it. They're being super literal about this ad. And the concept, I mean, again, the concept here is pretty straightforward and like vaguely unobjectionable, at least in this sense, right? It's like, look at all these cool things the iPad can do, despite the fact that it's thinner than your average issue of The Atlantic. It's like the advertising version of those viral tweets in which someone puts like a smartphone in one picture and then a pile of gear, right? Like a rotary phone and a BlackBerry and a GPS and a voice recorder and a flashlight, et cetera, et cetera. And then like there's a caption with the tweet that says something like, you know, all this technology and $1,990 would have cost you $80,000,000,000. And now it's like $5. What a steal, right? Yeah, it's a little dramatic to throw all those things in a pneumatic press and hit the button and crush them all. But, you know, look, you got to capture the consumer's attention. So I kind of get it. I think people are overreacting a little bit. I don't know, Alyssa, is everyone just a little on edge right now because all the AI stuff? Is that what's really driving all this?
I think everybody is definitely a little bit on edge. And I have to say, I hadn't actually watched this ad until about 5 minutes before this podcast and had a sort of what was this reaction about to this ad? Because the main thing that it conveyed to me is that it's, like, it's not a terribly successful ad for an iPad. And I think Apple is facing sort of a larger product confusion about what the iPad is for, right? I mean, one of the big developments in phones since the introduction of both the iPhone and the iPad is that phones themselves have gotten much physically larger. And, you know,
there's a whole category of device that people refer to as phablets with
yes.
a PH.
Yeah. And when the iPad came out, I was really excited about it. Like, I had a first generation one. I'm going to reveal myself to be just like even more of a massive dork than I normally reveal myself to be on this podcast. And confess that not only did I get like a first generation iPad, I had it engraved on the back to read a young lady's illustrated primer. Say, like, a head nod to Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age. Like,
literally on my desk right now. I'm reading it right now.
Yes.
That's a terrible reference. How dare you?
I'm very sorry for all of my sins. I'm extremely embarrassed. I will resign from the podcast immediately. But I never really figured out what it was for. You know, I used it for recipes, but then I was like, I was worried about getting it dirty because it was an expensive device. I had to like stick it behind, you know, a recipe protector. I could read comics on it, and I did that some, you know, and I think especially relevant to this ad, the creative stuff that I do, and like I am a self-confessed sort of craft mom, is stuff that has to be in the physical world. And not least because it's like, it's tactical stuff that I want to do with my kids. Like I spent a lot of this weekend like figuring out how to do some like basic tie-dye again after having not done that for a long time. You know, I like decoupaging with my kid. I do block printing when I am, is like my sort of, one of my like creative things that the kids can't do because it involves very sharp implements. But I don't need an iPad for any of these things. Like I have a cutting machine called a Cricut and I use fairly sophisticated software for that. But I like doing it on a laptop with a mouse so I can like adjust sizes. So I can just like be a little bit more precise with it and manipulate stuff more easily. And then just like pretty much everything else I want to be doing in the physical world, right? Like I'm not looking for a digital replacement of it. The stuffness, the physicality is the point. And if, you know, the sort of selling point of the iPad is that it's supposed to let me be creative without a bunch of bulky stuff, it's like, it's not a selling point for me. And I've never really figured out what else the iPad is for. I, you know, that old one bricked, I have never replaced it. I just think the use case for it is sort of slim. And if anything, I find the ad most annoying because I don't like feeling trapped in Apple's ecosystem, even though I kind of am. And the implication that like Apple knows what's best for me in yet another sphere of life is annoying, but not outraging.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that like I can understand a lot of having a lot of issues with this ad just from a like, what are you trying to sell us perspective? And again, I am sympathetic to the idea that like crushing all of these things is at best in bad taste because people like the physical stuff, right? Again, this is why LPs are booming. This is why turntables are a thing again. And like Alyssa, I've never quite understood the use of tablets outside of child distraction devices, like on an airplane. But at that point, I just get like a $100 Kindle Fire or whatever and not a $900 iPad. If I want to do production work, I do it on my MacBook Pro. I love Apple. I have nothing but Apple crap. I've got an Apple phone. I got an iPhone. I got a MacBook. The iPad has never done anything for me. But again, this ad doesn't make me angry about the weird use of the iPad. Why were people so mad, Peter?
I think people were so mad because they have never, ever carried a tuba, like, anywhere. And if you've carried a tuba somewhere, it's big. Even if you got, like, one of these nice, soft gig bags for it where you can kind of sling it over your shoulder and it makes it relatively easy to carry around, it's a big thing. Okay, so there wasn't a tuba in the ad, but there was either a baritone or a euphonium. I'm not sure which. And baritones and euphoniums are like tubas, but a little smaller. They basically play at the range that a trombone plays. So one step, they're one step smaller than a tuba, and so they go sort of up an octave or two relative to the tuba's range. And a euphonium is not as big as a tuba, but it's still really big. And if you could just put it in like a little sliver of a slightly bigger iPad thing, like a slightly bigger than an iPhone thing, that would be so convenient. Now, obviously, the euphonium that comes out of your iPad is not actually a euphonium. It's a little bit different. But I just like people don't understand how much of a pain it is to carry around a very large brass instrument. And I'm glad that Apple crushed one and put it into an iPad.
This is the thing is, if I ever were ever to buy an iPad, would want it to be filled with the souls of destroyed instruments like Shang Tsung in Mortal Kombat. I want to be able to call upon all of their spirits to aid me in my creative endeavors.
So let me make a slightly more serious case for this thing. For one thing, the ad works really great if you just do like the demonic possession version of it and play it backwards. That is actually a brilliant ad. This is not my idea, to be clear. This is somebody posted this on Twitter. But you just play the ad backwards. It's this little tiny thing expanding into all of these options for you.
Yeah.
And if they just had that idea rather than the reverse one of, we're going to crush the things you love. In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to take all of those things and they're all going to be in this little thing, but they're going to grow out of that. And it's become suddenly a great ad that that is pitched towards those people who would like to have a piano and a euphonium in their house, but you can't fit a piano and a euphonium in your house, even if you can afford one. Brass instruments are quite expensive, folks. Pianos, even cheap used pianos, can be quite expensive. Certainly good ones are very expensive, and they also take up a huge amount of space. And so what this ad is pitching people is two things. One is a pretty significant cost reduction for, yes, something that is synthetic, but is a pretty good second best variation for, say, for a musical instrument or a film camera or something like that, right? All of which are single use, one use devices, right? That are expensive, that are that can be like difficult to get, right? That are like they take up space, et cetera. And then there's space saving, right? It's not just space saving in terms of like, well, you don't have a piano in the room. It's also portable. You can take this anywhere. And so you can take your piano and your euphonium to the park, to on an airplane, to a hotel. If you've got a bright, like just wherever it is you get it, there's no place that you can't take an iPad. There are a lot of places you can't take a piano. And even if you can take a euphonium with you in a bunch of like theoretically, most parks don't want you out there playing the euphonium. Although I will say, like, there's sometimes a brass quintet at the local park. It's really great.
Is this your way of saying that because of your enormous dog and your enormous speakers, you have been unable to fit the euphonium and the piano you crave in your man cave? And so you will be buying this so you can go to the park and play the euphonium to your dog?
This is exactly right. You've figured me out. The subtext here, I was just waiting for somebody to put this together like a Christopher Nolan movie puzzle. Now, the whole thing here is that it is that the iPad is, even though the iPad Pro is relatively expensive as these devices go. I was looking at them. They're like $1,500, $1,600 for the top end models, maybe even a little bit more than that. Even though this is relatively expensive, it's still so much cheaper than all of the things that it can do than buying the single use devices that it doesn't quite one-to-one replace, but comes reasonably close, it provides a reasonably close facsimile. And this is like a thing that I just like really deeply believe in, is that for most people, the second best thing that is far cheaper and far more accessible is the best thing. Like I wrote a whole piece for Reason Magazine last year about like the greatness of Red Baron Pizza. And it was a little bit tongue in cheek, but also Red Baron Pizza is great because it's cheap and it's there. You don't need a whole freaking brick oven in a place, right? Like you don't need all of the accoutrement. It's $3 and it's a pizza when you need a pizza. It's faster than Domino's and it costs 20% as much as delivery, right? Like, and this is kind of the, Apple doesn't want to make that kind of that argument quite that explicitly because they think of themselves as a premium luxury good, unlike something like Red Baron, but they are basically saying, look, you can have a second best version of all of these things, and it's only going to cost you $1,500, which is, yes, a lot of money, but again, euphoniums are expensive.
I will say, I just looked up how much euphoniums cost, and on the website I found, they start at $1,979 and go up to more than $10,000.
Yes.
And for the amount of money that you spent on one high-end euphonium, you could buy everyone on this podcast an iPad.
Let me play the devil's advocate here and take
euphonium math.
I would say, in a serious way, one of the ways to look at this is as a revolt against the generalist. Think of it this way, right? Peter is making a fairly persuasive, I think, case that that most people do not need a top-end version of one thing. They're fine with multiple cheaper versions of a different thing, of many things, of things they want to play with, basically, of things they want to mess around with. And that, look, that's fine for most people for most things. But I will say that if you're a high-end music person, right, Peter, the idea of an iPad replacing your sound system is vaguely offensive, is it not? Is that not a thing that you would be like, well, that's ridiculous. I could never, that doesn't work. That's not a thing.
An iPad wouldn't replace your speakers, but an iPad might be part of your sound system. In fact, an iPad is part of my sound system and many high-end sound system, like audiophile guys, like, sorry, it's almost entirely dudes. It's just, what are we going to do here? Look at stereophiles, demographic, at like advertisement.
Yeah, 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 anyway, yeah.
No, the whole thing is, there's the thing that audiophiles use to manage digital music is called Rune. And Rune there's a bunch of different ways that you can implement it, but many, if not most of them, the interface that they choose to use is an iPad. And so that's just the interface, but it's a great touchscreen interface for looking at all of your music, and then you still have to buy speakers and often a music server and a streamer.
You're talking about fancy Winamp, like, okay, great, you have fancy Winamp on your iPad, but that doesn't replace,
so much fancier, that doesn't, so much more,
that doesn't replace your sound system. You know, if we put your subwoofer and your speakers into a hydraulic press and crushed it, it would be like, well, that's dumb. That'd
be
not
really
obviously
sad. Don't do that to my speakers.
So, but again, I think this is at least part of the pushback here is from people who think, all right, look, fine, yes, it has all these things, but none of them are as good as any of the individual things here. Like, I understand the idea of wanting to push back against the facsimile of being a Renaissance man or whatever, when, you know, none of these things are actually as good, or like the iPad is not actually as good as any of the individuals.
I will say there's a couple of applications where the iPad is close to the very best thing. And one of them is art applications for where you are drawing and doing digital drawing. And the new pencil that comes, the Apple Pencil that you can buy as an accessory to this, now has haptic feedback that allows it, that makes drawing on an iPad, particularly an iPad Pro, feel a little bit more like paper. And it just gives you a sort of tactile and direct control for doing digital art that is much better than using a mouse and, you know, creating, anyway, using a mouse with something like Adobe Illustrator. And so, like, that's a great application that is, in fact, probably, like, yes, there are drawing tablets that are specific to that, but the iPad is one of the best in class options for drawing. You also see iPads, if you look at behind the scenes photos of film sets, you see them all over. And you know why? Because they're really easy to hold in your hand and you can just sort of pan through the script with your finger, right? And so this is everybody, the script and the storyboards. And so if we're looking at sort of looking at digital images that you just sort of want to, right? You could do this on a laptop, but a laptop's a pain in the butt to carry around a film set. You could do it on your phone, but it's too small to kind of have the director or the script coordinator say, okay, we're doing this and it needs to look like, right, like, and point at this stuff. An iPad is perfect for those things, which is why you, like I said, if you look at behind the scenes photos of movie sets, especially sort of medium to large size movie sets over the last decade, you see a huge number of iPads on them. And they can also do playback, right? So, oh, we're just going to look at that shot one more time, right? Because they're just okay. a little more moderate. Anyway, a bunch of things that you can actually do with them that are very valuable. Also, they have really, the cameras keep getting better. And I will just point out that at least one feature-length movie has been shot on an iPhone. You could do it now that on a better,
all right,
on a better camera.
All right, let's wrap it up. This is taking forever, and none of us even think it's a controversy. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that Apple wants to literally crush your creative tools into digital paste? Alyssa?
It's an controversy. Apple has always wanted to take over the entire world, and that's why they hid by the behind the ridiculous 1984 ad in the first place. It's hard to, you know, denounce a totalitarian that comes to you in the guise of a revolutionary.
So, Alyssa, you're saying it's a non-controversy that Apple wants to destroy everything and take over the world, so many Coke.
We've always known this.
All right, Peter. Controversy or non-controversy?
Ridley Scott would have loved to shoot that ad on an iPad. It's actually a controversy because people are upset about the fact that things are cheaper and better and new, and like they need to get over that.
So it's a controversy that other people have transgressed your values of cheapness in the brand. It's a controversy. I watched the ad several times and I was like, I don't understand why everyone's so mad at this. You're all being very literal. Stop being so literal, people. It's not the point of these things. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus this Friday. We're going to be paying tribute to Roger Corman, who died this weekend at the age of 98. Farewell, King of the B-movies. And now on to the main event. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Just as a heads up, we're going to be talking some plot points here that weren't in the trailers. There's some fairly important stuff that needs to be discussed. So if you're really worried about spoilers, log off now, because we're going to talk about some monkeys. And I'm going to use monkeys and apes interchangeably. Spoiler again. That's just, I don't respect the apes enough to use just apes. If they're going to get mad, they can come yell at me in my room. They're mad at me. They can come bite my face off. Yeah, bring it on, chimps. All right, the sequel to War for the Planet of the Apes, which is the capstone of what we might call the Caesar Trilogy, which were three films that depicted the rise of a disease that wiped out most of humanity and the dawn of ape intelligence, leading to a war between humans and the apes, picks up hundreds of years after Caesar has died. Apes live in scattered settlements. Noah, who is played by Owen Teague, is a young chimp in one of those settlements. He and his people raise eagles as hunters. They get fish for the village. And scare off predators. They like to keep to themselves, right? They talk about the echoes and that they see in the woods. That's their word for humans. And they stay out of a tunnel that leads to a forbidden valley. And that's how they live. After encountering one of these echoes, a tribe of angry apes using Caesar's names, shouting, you know, Hail Caesar, whatever, storm the village, taking Noah's apes prisoner, not people, and marching them back to their encampment, right? The angry apes, the mad, bad apes, they're looking for the human who Noah encountered, and Noah and his erstwhile orangutan ally, Raka, played by Peter Macon, decide to protect this girl, believing, as Caesar did, that the humans and the apes should live together in peace. But it turns out the girl has ideas of her own. She can speak, she can think, she's got her own name. She doesn't want to be called Nova, her name is May. She's headed to the village run by Proxima Caesar for reasons all of her own. Now, there are a lot of interesting ideas in this movie that are kind of half teased out, right? One of them is the role of religion in society. Caesar's name has been taken by Proximus, both literally and symbolically, right? He waves the bloody flag of Caesar and ape advancement without actually living the teachings that Caesar embodied. Raka, on the other hand, he's a monk of sorts. He believes that apes must walk the path shown by Caesar. He understands the importance of the written word. And though neither he nor any other ape can read or write, he understands that transmitting knowledge through the generations is the way to achieve forward cultural and technological momentum. On the human side of things, there are two interesting characters. There's the Echo Nova, who we learn is actually named May again. She hopes to recover a piece of technology from the apes. But more than that, she wants to make sure that Proximus does not gain access to human technology like tanks and rifles. She believes that Earth is humanity's and wants to reclaim it from the monkeys who have spread all over it. And on the other hand, you have Trevathan, who is played by William H. Macy. He believes the humans must work with, really for, the apes. He's happy to be a subordinate to Proximus Caesar. He amuses Proximus with his stories from history, and he helps helps Proximus and his men fashion kind of cattle prod style stun guns. And here, this is, all of this is kind of interesting, but my big problem with Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is this. It looks great. It's a fun action chase movie. It's fine. It feels shorter than its 2.5-hour running time. It's kind of long, but it feels shorter than that. It zips along pretty nicely. But it really only faints at the ideas at its core. This whole thing, particularly the last 45 minutes or so, really feel like a very long prologue for a series of more interesting sequels, pitting humans against the apes. And I'm looking forward to those movies, frankly. I'm looking forward to those movies because I am team humanity in the human-monkey struggle. I'm sorry. These apes have been gifted with intelligence and language. They've done nothing with it. The world is in ruins. They have no technology. They can't even read. They don't even know what ice is, probably. They don't deserve Earth. They don't deserve Earth. This is our planet. We should take it back. Monkeys, go home. This is for humans. That's what I say. Peter, why do so many humans in the audience watching these movies instinctively take the side of these damn dirty apes?
Well, I'm just hung up on you talking about monkeys biting your face because I was once in a joke metal band that had a song called Monkeys Are Biting My Face. And we would stage a monkey, a monkey versus punk fight while playing the song. There was a lot of fake blood. And that, it just brought me back. And now I like don't even know what I think about this movie. This movie is, I think you are right that this movie is fine to pretty good and gestures at a bunch of really interesting ideas. And it is sort of like, hey, there's a kind of thought about how society might evolve in the aftermath of like an apocalypse, right? And like where the simians became very smart. And then it's like, well, we're going to resolve that with a dam being broken. Like, that's it, right? They just resolve everything in sort of action chase stuff. I think the movie could get away with more of its gesturing at ideas if the two main characters, May and Noah, were a little more interesting. And this is the thing I've been thinking about in the days since I've seen this movie, is it works pretty well. Like, it's not boring. It's not ugly. It's pretty competent moment to moment, but I don't think I really cared about those characters. And May in particular is just a total blank. You know nothing about her or about what motivates her until essentially the epilogue, the coda to the film, right? It's totally unclear what she's about. We get this one little bit about how she's been trained to stay silent, you know, so she's playing, like she can't speak and like she's a dumb human, even though at least some of the humans, I'm not even actually sure, are all the humans actually like still intelligent? And the whole thing about how the disease out, right? It's just some of them, right? But no, like some of them are still quite...
We see like a flock of humans who are clearly dumb.
Clearly dumb, humans. Except that we know that May has been playing dumb. And so maybe they're also playing dumb because she...
Well, they're all wearing rags.
Yeah, you know, she was like a scampering along, like just acting like basically like a, you know, like a wolf following, you know, the Neanderthals, hoping to pick up some scraps. But she's acting animal-like. And maybe that's what they're doing too. The movie at least allows for that. I don't think that... I think you're probably right, Sonny. But the whole thing is like the... Noah is not a character who I like hated. I just, it's not that much to him. He sort of feels like a kind of a blank YA character. May totally has absolutely nothing to her. I couldn't tell you a thing about her or her motivation except like throughout, you know, the first 2 hours and 18 minutes of this 2.5 hour movie. Like, you don't know anything about what she's about. And because you don't have developed big ideas, and you also don't have lead characters who are really gripping and who really command your attention and your sympathy, the movie is, it's surprisingly pretty good for something that you know lacks those things, but it's also not that memorable, and I think not nearly as good as the first three of the reboot trilogy here, all of which had quite memorable characters and developed their big ideas much better.
Alyssa, I want to push back slightly on what Peter's saying here with regard to May, because I actually thought that was one of the best pieces of characterization in this film, the kind of slowly revealing her to be more understanding of the world around her than anybody else thinks, and thus everybody kind of taking her, kind of underestimating her. But then there's like a conscious heel turn moment almost when, you know, she... spoilers. If you're really worried about it, you shouldn't be listening now. But there's this moment where Trevathan confronts them on the bridge, and she just straight up murders him and chucks his body into the water. And it's like, oh, that's interesting. I did not see that coming. And it just shows that she's very serious about doing what she needs to do, protecting her people, but also like her visceral disgust at his, what she sees as his treason against humanity. I actually found her characterization very, very interesting. But again, to like half agree with Peter still, I do feel like it's like teasing something more interesting in future installments. Like I wanted more of that.
Yeah. I'm going to not answer your question because I have a different argument that I want to make. I actually think there's a really strong counter argument. This would be a much better movie with no humans in it at all. because the conflict that is actually interesting in the movie is, and the sort of source of the big idea is the conflict between like Rocca's vision of Caesar and Caesar's memory and Proximus's vision of Caesar and Caesar's memory, right? And I forgot who said this on Twitter. It might have been in New York Times' Alyssa Wilkinson. But this whole thing is a movie about early Christianity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, it is, you know, it is the story of a small group of people who are sort of loyal to an idea up against an imperium, against a literal Caesar, who has sort of, you know, perverted and co-opted some of these big ideas in an attempt to sort of maintain a dominance that, you know, no one else but this small group of core believers can see is sort of destined to fall. And I think the really sort of gutsy, interesting thing would be to do away with this sort of human-ape conflict altogether and, like, actually make this a, you know, like, the first trilogy is the Old Testament and the second trilogy is the New Testament, right? Like, that would be one of the, like, sort of ballsiest things I can think of an action franchise doing in a franchise that's already sort of set the standard for being unusual and surprising and, you know, tender and just audacious as a piece of, you know, a revitalization of intellectual property. Like, the moments where Noah is trying to figure out, like, what the hell to make of Rocca are some of the most enjoyable ones in the movie. And I think it's no mistake that the most gripping action sequence is the one that ends in, you know, Rocca's sort of self-sacrifice, right? Like, the scene on the bridge is, you know, sort of austere. It's not that huge scale. It's genuinely scary. And again, it's sort of, you know, linked to the theme. I thought the sort of muddy CGI indoor sort of final fight sequence in this was fight slash chase sequence was really not good and irritating. I went back and rewatched the second movie in the first reboot trilogy. How you even describe any of these things is beyond me. And it has like a much, you know, much better sort of dark fight scenes, just like much more compelling and interesting than this sort of CGI mess.
Matt Reeves's action scenes in this, in the second and third reboots, were incredibly crisp.
Yeah, and built around exciting and upsetting character work. So, I mean, I see what you're saying, Sonny. I think that's probably sort of the best case for May's character in the movie, but I cannot help but think what a better, tighter version of this movie would have been as the actual sort of Christians versus Romans version of the movie.
I like your comment there, just because you focus attention on Rocca and the relationship between Noah and Rocca, which is probably the most interesting relationship in the movie, maybe followed by the William H. Macy's Trevathan and Caesar. But the whole thing is that Rocca is the movie's best character. And he is in the movie for one quarter of the film. He shows up basically when we get into the second act and he dies in the middle of the movie. So he is there for, I don't know, 35 or 40 minutes at most. And those are some of the best 35 or 40 minutes. And they sort of set up what is to come. But it's all a little bit of a letdown because Rocca is both smart and, like, you care about him because he's sort of a smart weirdo. But he's also funny. And this, you know, like, some of the best CGI in this movie is just the facial expressions, like the ability, the performance that that Peter Macon and then the Weta, you know, effects artists pulled out of that character. And the movie kind of, it doesn't struggle exactly, but it is not, it's not as tight after he goes away.
The problem with this whole dynamic, and I agree, like, in my notes while I was watching the movie, is that, like, Caesar is basically a godhead, but with no rituals surrounding him, and there's no dogma except the one that Proximus adopts, which is one of power. Like, there's no the problem with this movie from that perspective is that if you have all of these apes, none of whom can read, none of whom can actually propagate a religious belief system outside of, like, Caesar. That was an ape that existed once upon a time. He said some things, I guess. We don't know because we can't keep track of any of it. Like, you would have to have the apes actually advance.
Yeah. And I think that a savvier, again, if you were going to follow the sort of Christians versus Romans metaphor, like having, you know, showing us that you have a society that is largely illiterate, but where like a sort of privileged class of people knows how to read, would tie all of that together in like a much neater way. Because you could, again, you could have some dogma be sort of passed down over time. You could have some, you know, you could have some people who are sort of the true keepers of the flame. You could have sort of more of a kind of storytelling tradition around Caesar. I mean, you could have like a priestly class, right? And, you know, this movie sort of brings that, the idea of a priestly class in with the eagle stuff, but doesn't, again, sort of connect that to the core theme. And that's especially sort of a bummer because, you know, you do see, like, actually in the second movie in the original trilogy, like, the other orangutan character is, like, you do start to see, like, the writing on the cliffs. You have, like, a rudimentary school for the younger apes. So, like, they were developing writing at some point. They were developing, like, you know, you see the, like, the flowers, the feathers, the face paint, like you see all of this cultural stuff that is developing. And so absent some sort of cataclysm, it doesn't totally make sense that the apes would move backwards.
Or I mean, it's because stagnant. They're apes. That's the problem. They don't have human capabilities. That's why the humans got to take back over. That's why I disagree with you. I think that it's going to be great to have the humans back. Taking over, retaking the planet of the apes and making it the planet of the humans once again.
Yeah. I mean, it's also just a bummer that they sort of recapitulate the human plot to, like, get the communications devices back going from, you know, from this second movie.
Unclear exactly what they want to do, really, with the, like, you're all living in bubbles around the world. Like, yeah. what are you really going to do here?
Like, and also, like, how come May can go back out and then back in? Like, again, the sort of development of the, like, the sort of species branching of humans doesn't quite make sense.
It's kind of bananas.
Okay, now I want the monkey to bite your face off, Peter.
I take it all back. Humans are not advanced. All right, what do we think? Is it a thumbs up or thumb down on Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes? Peter.
Thumbs up, but not a movie that I'm eager to see, you know, two or three times again. And I'm happy to have seen it once.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up, but mostly in the sense that it made me go back and rewatch the original trilogy, which is just freaking fantastic.
Thumbs up. It's fine. Okay, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.